Please be aware that this podcast has reference to drug and alcohol use and paraphernalia and may not be appropriate for some people in early recovery. Everyone, my name is Dr. Mahjubeen Islam.
And I am Dr. Ketli Daniels.
And we want to thank you for listening to our Treat Addiction podcast. The information in this podcast cannot replace your seeking a treatment provider, which you can easily do at SAMHSA's National Helpline at findtreatment.gov or 1-800-622-4357. In the last episode, we had talked a little bit about agonist opioids like methadone and oxycodone. Partial agonist opioids like buprenorphine, better known as Suboxone, and antagonists to opioids like naltrexone. In this episode, we will talk about medications for opioid use disorder that are taken orally. I think it would be fair to say that with the opioid epidemic and the success of treatment in dealing with opioid addiction, this might be the most important episode for patients suffering from opioid use disorder, as well as their families and communities to listen to.
Suboxone was launched in 2001, and it didn't get referred to as buprenorphine, which is generically what it's called, but as Suboxone. And incidentally, I just want to point out to people that Suboxone is used not only for opioid addiction, but also as pain management. So you might hear it used for that these days as well.
Mm-hmm. There are other branded versions of Suboxone like Zubsolve and generic alternatives also. All of them are actually a combination of a partial opioid agonist called buprenorphine and an antagonist called naloxone.
A lot of people think that the reason that Suboxone works is because it has the antagonist, naloxone. But actually, the main ingredient of Suboxone and why it works is the opioid buprenorphine. The naloxone is in there because it gets active only when it is injected to prevent people from injecting the Suboxone. If injected, the person will go into opioid withdrawal, which is very uncomfortable. And we talked about that before, the discomfort of...
Right. When you take it by mouth, or actually what we call sublingually, in that it is put under the tongue and dissolves slowly, the naloxone is not active. It's just the buprenorphine that is.
As a psychiatrist, I'm very vested in the effect of behavior on any disease. And in any addiction, we cannot stress enough that the person must learn about the disorder. It's crucial to learn to change their relationship with the product that they're addicted to. In counseling, they're taught methods that they can use to stay off the drug. For example, how to manage stress, how to identify triggers. They must remember that if you keep doing what you've always done, you will keep getting what you've always gotten.
Yeah.
And just like I used to say, I love saying this, you can't be a little pregnant, so you can't just dabble once in a while. You cannot be a little pregnant.
Good one. It is important to remember that in mild opioid addiction, like say someone is taking 2 to 4 Percocet a day, it is possible to stop the opioid and just deal with the treatment with counseling alone. Like we said, the phrase cold turkey comes from opioid withdrawal, in which the person is hot and cold and has goosebumps.
True. I want to also stress the importance of behavioral treatment of opioid addiction. This can take the form of counseling, specifically geared towards addiction, and also 12-step programs like Narcotics Anonymous. And some of my patients actually found even your generic AA meetings helpful to them as well. We've been discussing that opioid addiction is like diabetes. And just like diabetes, we cannot treat it by just stopping sugar intake or telling the person to shape up.
Yeah, it's funny that I've been doing this so long that I have these little sayings. And one of them is that I'll tell my patients that opioid addiction or alcoholism or any other form of addiction is a chronic disease. And it is the patient's choice to either live and die using or live and die sober. And to achieve meaningful recovery, it is so important for the person to understand how the addiction started, what their triggers are, what they need to do to prevent relapse or using again. And that is why I really think pretty much all persons with opioid addiction should have some degree of behavioral therapy, so these factors can be understood as they apply specifically to them.
So what do you suggest we tell patients if they want to go cold turkey? Just tough it out, suffer through it?
Oh, no, no. We have help. The first thing, though, is to know that opioid withdrawal does not kill, even if the person feels like hell. Even if we did not do anything, the symptoms of restlessness, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, trouble sleeping, and the muscle and bone pain will go away in 3 to 5 days with most opioids. But your doctor can always prescribe some ibuprofen for bone and muscle pain, Zofran for nausea, Imodium for diarrhea, and Benadryl for sleep to just make it all easier.
You know, I can't imagine going through several days of feeling that uncomfortable. When the addiction is a bit more intense, what do you suggest the patient do?
Yeah, and that's really the thrust of our podcast today, that all our research tells us the best way to deal with moderate to severe opioid addiction is to use medication for opioid use disorder. Not only do medications make the withdrawal non-existent, they take care of the craving that the person feels after the withdrawal is gone.
We talked about Suboxone being a revolutionary medication like penicillin and steroids. Can you talk more about that?
I feel so humbled to be able to do this. Penicillin, as you know, changed the course of human history, and steroids have saved millions of patients. And if you look at the research and the results, it is proven that methadone and Suboxone prevent overdose deaths. And methadone has been around for opioid addiction since 1976, but it is only recommended for severe opioid addiction and if the person keeps relapsing on Suboxone, for it is more dangerous than Suboxone. And it is actually Suboxone that has revolutionized addiction treatment and saved numerous lives.
So how does the process work then? I mean, what does a patient do if they cannot kick the habit on their own?
So like we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, when the person is ready for treatment, they should look up a provider if they don't already have one on SAMHSA's national helpline at findtreatment.gov or 1-800-622-4357. What the provider will do is instruct the patient to present in a state of withdrawal with not having used drugs for 2 days if the patient uses heroin or Percocet or fentanyl. It is a different story if the person's drug of choice is methadone, because then they need to be off the methadone for at least 3 days, and the highest last dose of methadone should be 30 milligrams.
Wow. It can be a little complicated for the person listening to this podcast. So I'm thinking maybe we can focus on the more common drugs, because the commonest drugs of use are heroin, Percocet, Vicodin, and fentanyl.
Exactly. I think it's much simpler to do that. So with them, we ask people to abstain from use for about 2 days. And when the patient comes in, the provider takes a history of the patient's drug use and their medical history, does a physical exam, and assesses how much Suboxone will be needed.
You also do a drug screen, correct?
Yes, we do, because that gives us an idea as to what the patient has been using.
And what do you usually find in those screens?
We usually find opioids, and many a time we'll also find marijuana and sometimes the dreaded benzodiazepines like Xanax and Ativan.
I think our listeners will be wondering, why did she say dreaded? What does that mean?
Like we discussed in our previous episode, both opioids and drugs like Xanax and Ativan depress the respiratory center, meaning they stop the breathing center in the base of the brain from working properly. And when we receive coroner's reports on overdose deaths, very commonly it is these two drugs that have been combined. That's why I call it dreaded.
I see. So the patient comes into your office, they have a urine screen done and it's positive for opioids. What do you do next?
So I determine the dose of the Suboxone that they're going to need and give them some important instructions, like they cannot use any drugs or alcohol, which is something they sign for in our treatment consent. The method by which the Suboxone is taken, in that it is important that it's dissolved under the tongue and that it's not swallowed, because we want it to go through the veins that are under the tongue. I also tell them to make sure that their Suboxone is kept locked. And this invariably gives them, they feel very surprised by it for some reason. And they say, I tell them that it has to be in a locked cabinet or a lockbox or a safe, because if Suboxone reaches a child, they will die. And even adults who have not used opioids, who we call opioid naive, can suffer a lot. And the sad part is, and I think it just, people just don't realize that people steal other people's medications. And I came across this weird sort of episode or instance in which when people put up their house for a showing, it's crazy that the people who come in to see the house actually go through people's medicine cabinets and steal their medications.
Incredible.
And if there's an opioid in there, I mean, like, that is probably what they're looking for. But it can be very, very disastrous. And people always will tell me things like, oh, no, no one comes here except my, you know, so-and-so relative. And they don't realize that friends and relatives steal their medicines, too.
That's a fact. That's a fact. So the patient comes in, they're assessed. How do you decide how much Suboxone to prescribe in the first visit?
So this is where I think there's also the art and science of medicine, in which if you take a full proper history and you estimate, you know how much they're taking in terms of whether it's mild opioid use disorder or moderate or severe, I prescribe enough Suboxone based on that. And we literally count it out when we prescribe it, and it suffices only till the next visit. So I usually end up seeing them back in 2 to 4 days. So the urine drug screen at that point will become negative for opioids, hopefully. And then we are able to assess if they need more of the Suboxone, which will then be increased.
And we should also inform our audience that they are being tested for the Suboxone in their bloodstream, I mean, in their urine. So the buprenorphine should be positive, but not the opioids.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
So when they come in, you don't just randomly prescribe them 16 milligrams of Suboxone, right?
I see that you say that tongue-in-cheek, because you too have suffered intimidation by patients. And most patients who come in, like we mentioned before, they're really, patients are very, once they get to the point of treatment, they've done their investigation to quite a degree, and the addiction community is pretty connected. And they already, a lot of them have already been on Suboxone before, so they know, or at least they think they know what they want. Not what they need, but what they want. And a 36-year-old patient of mine comes, I can remember, that she'd been in treatment before and figured she would direct her own care. And I would be the little peon that would carry out her orders. She was hugely upset when I told her that I would not be starting her on 16 milligrams right away.
And I think, unfortunately, they come in and just expect you to just treat them the way they want to be treated, straight intimidation or a combination of both. So what do you do next?
So, but this one was a straight up boss. Okay. This was like, I'm gonna direct the treatment.
This is what I want.
Yes, yes. But you do also have the ones that start out sweet, and when things are not going their way, they put on their nasty face.
Seen that.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to ask you this. Are you a pushover? Like, do you let them boss you around? Because in my practice, we tend to follow a certain protocol. And then when we need to deviate, then we deviate. How do you handle these bossy people?
So do you think I could be a pushover?
Nah.
I can see you.
Nah. Not a thing.
Just the other day, one of my patients who's been in the program for 10 years was telling me her story and how she checked me out before she came to the office and described me as a tough doc. That's my reputation on the street.
We'll get you a badge.
Yes.
My name is Tough Doc.
Tough Doc.
I have found that some patients who are addicted really do need a direct approach. And some call it tough love, but they need for us to establish boundaries and set limits with them immediately and stick with that same narrative throughout their treatment.
It's so true, because a lot of, particularly if addiction starts at a young age, the patient has no structure. Mm-hmm. They have no boundaries. And though they kick and scream in the beginning, they are deeply grateful for this later on in their recovery. Like everything else in medicine, the dose of the Suboxone obviously has to be tailored to the patient. And just like in golf and tennis, I like to give this analogy because it really does work. There is a sweet spot. And though the addicted patient likes to believe that their sweet spot is 16 milligrams, there are times when it is 8 milligrams. And I try to explain to them, you know, that if I jump to 16 and your sweet spot is 8, we've missed the sweet spot. We're not going to, because you don't generally go down from 16 to 8. The patient will not tolerate that. Mm-hmm. They will only go the other direction. They will go from down to up. starting low and going slow is a maxim in medicine that you've heard of.
I've even had just a couple of people in the past who came in on 24 milligrams.
Correct.
Yeah. So what is the other reason then that you don't do a blanket 16 milligrams for everyone?
Because studies show that the chance of people selling or sharing their Suboxone goes up if the dose is higher than 8 milligrams. Because at 8 milligrams, for most people, the brain's mu receptors are saturated and they are quite comfortable. So the extra that they have, they'll just sell or share.
And they do. And it's a nice chunk of change, too.
Mm-hmm.
I've had individuals with mild use and mild symptoms who have needed only 4 milligrams. So walk me through a typical patient's course in your office.
And, you know, thank you for that, because like in everything else in medicine, there has to be a treatment plan with full disclosure to the patient about what they should expect. While I describe the treatment to them, I tell them that they will initially be seen weekly, then every 2 weeks, then 3 weeks. And finally, after 6 months of a good recovery course, they come to the office every 4 weeks and we affectionately call them monthers.
But that is the typical and usual patient. What happens with the patient who keeps using and their urine drug screen is often positive? And week after week, we have the same discussion. What do you do with them?
Yeah, and you know, the urine drug screen, we have a witnessed urine drug screen because people with addictions are very innovative and they have all sorts of ways to give you a negative or the kind of drug screen that you want. So we have, we could probably do a podcast on an episode on urine drug screen drama or something like that.
So I have some good stories.
Yes,
as well,
exactly.
So
we could fill them in. That's a good thought. Maybe we can. But there's a premise in addiction medicine called dissecting the relapse. Each time an unexpected or disallowed substance shows up in the urine drug screen, or if the patient reports continued drug use, we take a detailed history, and that's really, really important to see what is causing the relapse. Like, what is causing the patient to use? And in the science of medicine, the etiology or the cause of an illness is very, very important. Similarly, we need to examine why this is happening. It can be that they're still hanging around the wrong people, or they're not completely committed to recovery and might be doing this for others rather than just for themselves. And in some cases, the dose of the Suboxone is not enough. And while it is important not to be pressured by the patient or just willy-nilly raise the dose of the Suboxone, on the other hand, it is important to believe the patient and not act like a principal or a prison guard. And I think the premise of giving the patient the benefit of the doubt, like we give the patient the benefit of the doubt in pain, we cannot quantify pain. Mm-hmm. So similarly, in withdrawal and in craving, you have to give the patient the benefit of the doubt instead of looking at the patient like a criminal, sadly.
And I think it's also important that we don't dismiss or discount our clinical intuition, because you have a sense that this person is genuinely in distress and I should treat, you know, the symptoms. And then you have those that you think,
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Over the years, has treatment of addiction changed very much?
It certainly has. Years ago, we operated on the premise of abstinence and zero tolerance for use. We now realize, especially in the model of addiction being a chronic disease, that we need to meet the patient where they are. And I was just giving a PowerPoint on stimulant use disorders, and I was telling them that we have to learn to pivot. And we need to work with them to the best of our abilities without compromising their care. And this is the concept of harm reduction. The aim is abstinence, but if there is reduction in use, that also is a big win.
Yeah, definitely. Although it is challenging to give credibility to individuals who, because of their addiction, have lived lives of lies and stealing and, you
exactly.
know.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a tough concept to deal with. And, you know, perhaps it is because I love the practice of addiction medicine and put my heart and soul in it that patients will say things. This is such a marginalized community that they'll say that I haven't been treated with respect and consideration like this before. And that just blows me away, that how we mistreat patients and people is a really, really sad thing because of our biases. Mm-hmm. And like we talked about in the previous episode, the opioid epidemic is an iatrogenic disease, because meaning it was created by the medical system to quite a degree. Mm-hmm. And the catch-22 is that we still treat these patients very poorly and very differently from others who have a chronic disease. And I think this resistance to recognizing this as a chronic disease is because money is involved. I kind of like figured this out. Like, why don't people understand, like, crying horse that opioid use disorder, addiction, substance use disorder is a chronic disease? And then one day I had an epiphany, because it involves money. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the burden of a chronic disease, but the families have to deal with a bankruptcy.
Yeah, it's very sad. So how would you handle a patient who comes in for a second or third visit and is still positive for opioids, and wants their dose increase, saying that it's just not enough? Would you raise the dose even though you had assessed that their use was moderate and not severe?
I would. Just like pain, like I just mentioned, opioid withdrawal is different for different people. And even though their addiction may not have been severe, it is a possibility that their withdrawal is. And very much in line with the Hippocratic Oath and the compassion of medicine, as long as the patient is not using benzodiazepines or alcohol with their Suboxone, it is quite safe to raise the dose and give them the benefit of the doubt.
And I think it's important for us as clinicians to, you know, first do no harm.
Yes.
Treat the patient, you know, not your biases or your preconceived ideas. But can you share a bit about the phases of treatment?
So the phases of treatment are important to understand, particularly for the patient and their family, so they know that it is a protocol and a process. And just like at the end of like a cake baking event, you have a beautiful product. If you can just stick through it, it's a beautiful product. So the first start is, or at the start, it's called induction. And then stabilization, when we stabilize the dose. Maintenance, when we maintain the patient on treatment, and then in the end comes weaning, when we reduce and stop the medication.
You know, it is a beautiful transformation when you see someone who comes in and they're just totally broken, and then as they get through the treatment, they get better and better, and then they get their lives back on track again, and they get into counseling. It's nice to watch.
That's why I call it turnarounds.
Yeah, it's
literally a turnaround.
Do people come into treatment with their minds made up about how long, at least in your experience, how long they want to be on Suboxone?
They sure do. You know, opioid use disorder patients have a lot of things already worked out when they come in. And some of them come in with what I call righteous indignation and some self-contempt too, which is sad. And they want to be on Suboxone for a few months only. And in this group, after we have educated them, some remain on Suboxone indefinitely, which is fine. Because as you remember, Suboxone prevents overdose deaths. There are some who have been through their own personal exercise of stopping and withdrawal, et cetera, and the yo-yo effect, you know. And they are comfortable with being on 8 milligrams indefinitely. So it just varies, and we have to tailor the treatment to the patient.
We know about the partial agonists like Suboxone and Zubsolv. What other oral treatments are available?
So the antagonist naltrexone is available as a pill, but our studies show that it doesn't work well with opioid or alcohol addiction because the patient can stop taking it. I do use it before injecting someone with Vivitrol, which is the injectable form of naltrexone, but we will deal with that in a future episode on injectables. But just talking about oral naltrexone, I do have a patient who has been sober now for 5 years on oral naltrexone.
Awesome.
So that takes a good deal of commitment mm-hmm. and cognition, understanding, but he's very successful.
But isn't methadone also an oral treatment for opioid addiction?
It sure is, and the smart cookie that you are, you recognize that I'm very tilted towards Suboxone, and the reason for this is that when used properly, Suboxone is very safe. Methadone definitely has its place, but it's largely reserved for people who have severe opioid addiction or are unable to maintain sobriety on Suboxone, or they have a very compromised social and economic situation. Like we just talked about, like we have Suboxone turnarounds of patients who have done marvelously, and their lives have been changed in 3 months, the same can easily be said for methadone. And there are definitely instances in which a person may be on methadone treatment for a while, and then when they are nice and stable, they are thereafter transferred onto Suboxone.
The only thing I find with methadone, not the only thing, there are a couple, but one thing that I have issues with is that it actually ties the patient to the clinic. I know someone who was going across the border to the methadone clinic, and they actually had hours of operation from 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. to accommodate people so that they can go back and forth every morning to get the dose. And I cannot discount it because I had one individual who was incidentally mentioned to me that he was on methadone for years. He'd never mentioned that from the beginning. But he had been going to methadone clinics for at least 3 or 4 years. And he was sober.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because people don't realize that, you know, like there are turnarounds with Suboxone. There are definitely turnarounds with methadone as well. Mm-hmm. And on the basis of the chronic disease model, we try for the patients to be integrated into society. That is the whole idea. Instead of being like, you know, segregated and separated from the mainstream of living, the main issue that I've had with methadone is that they're in a sense that segregation applies. And in there initially, they have to go daily. After a certain point and with sobriety, they do get a month's worth of methadone, but it comes after a long time. And we call them take homes. The second reservation I have with methadone is that typically in methadone clinics, very high doses of methadone tend to be used. And when the patient relapses with using a second opioid or if they use a benzodiazepine, the chance of an overdose death becomes very high. And this does not apply that much to Suboxone. It can, but usually the dose is not high enough for that to happen. And Suboxone, as you know, is a partial agonist, has a ceiling effect.
I understand that in Canada and Europe that the doctors there can give methadone in their clinics like we give Suboxone here. Is that true?
It is, and I'm very hopeful that we will see the day when primary care physicians as well as addiction medicine physicians will be able to give methadone for opioid addiction in their offices. But, you know, everything boils down at the end of the day to that terrible quantity called money. And methadone clinics have become a bit of a business. And I kind of feel that it is an insult to physicians that hoops and obstacles have been created around methadone maintenance, even though with education, there's no reason that physicians cannot prescribe methadone appropriately to patients in their office for addiction. Right now, as you know, doctors with a DEA license can give methadone for pain.
Yeah, it's changed now. It used to be the waiver you had to get in order to prescribe the Suboxone. I think we've covered a lot in this episode, and this should inform some patients to how to get help and how to guide others towards seeking treatment for themselves or for their loved ones.
We have. There have been development of more forms of treatment, which are very exciting and which we will deal with in the next episode. In the next episode, we will primarily discuss the treatment of opioid addiction with injectables. So we discussed the treatment in this one with orals. In that, there will be the injectable. So it's going to be an exciting episode, I think, because we'll discuss how the patient does not have to be taking Suboxone daily. They're not tied down, speaking of being tied down. And they just have to see the physician on a monthly basis. We really hope that you are enjoying our podcast series. Please subscribe and share the podcast with family and friends. You can continue listening on wgte.org/treataddiction or anywhere you get your podcasts. Just search for Treat Addiction. Because it is only through awareness and education that we can tackle this epidemic together. I'm your host and producer, Dr. Mahjubeen Islam.
And I am your co-host, Dr. Ketley Daniels.
And our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. Until the next episode, do remember, patience in difficult times and gratitude always. See you soon.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.